You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Daniels. Laura Feldman could be termed a Washington insider. As a long-term organizer for the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, a leading nonpartisan group, she has expert knowledge on the issue of health care reform and how it will impact seniors, Social Security, and Medicare. Ms. Feldman brings her skills as a teacher to educating senior groups and activists across the country. She is a native of Washington, D.C., where politics is local sport. Demystifying politics, personalizing it, and making it fun is one of her goals. Ms. Feldman spoke at the Wednesday, September 9, 2009 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia, held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Our podcast is entitled A View from the Hill, Social Security and Medicare, Where from Here? Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. Today's program was moderated by SSV Secretary Bill Davis.
Thank you. We will have an opportunity after Laura speaks to ask questions. So, and we'll come around with mics to do that. So if you be thinking of questions you might want to ask. It's a real pleasure and honor for me to introduce our speaker, Laura Feldman. Laura is you can call her a Washington insider. She was born in the Washington area. She grew up there. She went to school there, and she currently is an 18-year employee the grassroots organizer of the National Committee to preserve Social Security and Medicare. This organization is the leading advocacy group in the country. It has over 4 million members, has 78,000 members here in Virginia. They are the nonpartisan advocacy group for Social Security and Medicare. They do every day, they go to work for people like you and I in Washington. Doesn't matter who the administration is, they're in there working hard to see that Social Security and Medicare are carried on just like it should be. Laura is a graduate of American University. She has a long background in senior issues. She, prior to coming to work for the National Committee, she was the she organized national programming for the National Science Foundation. She's past president of the Southern Gerontological Society. She's on the Board of Trustees for the Florida Silver-Haired Legislature. I could go on and on and on, but she's very involved in many things involving people of our age. So it's my great pleasure and my honor to introduce my dear friend, Laura Feldman.
I want to thank Mr. Hilton for inviting me, and I thank you, Bill, for inviting me, and I thank all of you for coming. It's a pleasure to represent to present to the senior statesmen of Virginia. I know you all care about the issues enough to come and hopefully learn something today. So this is a two-way street. I will take any questions, and if you think you might not remember it, you can ask me in the middle, because I know I forget if I don't interrupt my husband. Okay, here's what we're going to do. First, we're going to talk politics, because politics is in all of our lives. If we understand the politics that surround the issues that we're talking about today, we will better understand who is saying what. Then we're going to talk about Social Security, Medicare, and health care. So that's the program. Who in this room knows the origin of the word politics? Anybody? Polemical comes from the Greek word poly, meaning many-sided, ticks, meaning bloodsuckers. Politicians are like diapers. They have to be changed regularly and for the same reason. Don't correct me yet. We're not going to talk about the statesman. I'm staying far away. We'll talk about Congress in a minute. The reason I want to talk about the politicians is because we define ourselves by being Democrats or Republicans or independents. Do I have any Democrats in the room? Raise your hand. Be proud. Excellent. Republicans, I hope. Independents. Okay, would you lock the door in the back, please? We're all in the same room. That's the good part. That's what democracy is all about. So what I want to teach you in the beginning, something you may not have thought about, who are these people? Who are the people on the other side of the aisle that I am on? So let's talk about them. Let's go to the right. I'm on the right. I'm a Republican. I'm a conservative. And by the way, I want to remind you, no matter how flat the pancake, there's always two sides. So on this side, who am I? If I'm a Republican, I believe in less government. I don't like big government. I believe that we should give the power to the states, the county, the residents, and most of all, give it to me. Personal responsibility. Let me decide how to best spend my money. Remember, the Personal Responsibility Act was also called the Contract with America. So I believe, let me make my decisions. Let me take care of myself and my own. I believe in free market reform. I believe, let the market decide, because I believe in the trickle-down effect. Remember that from Ronald Reagan? The trickle-down effect I like to call the incontinence effect. It does trickle down, but you don't know when and you don't know where. But the idea is, if business does well, we all do well. So we really want to support business. We want to give them tax breaks. We don't want to strangle them with too much regulation. We want the free market to prevail, because we really do believe that's the best way for the government to run, for the country to run. So free market reform, less government, power to the states, personal responsibility, very important basic issues of our ideology. Come over here, my lefties, my Democrats, the people on the other side of the aisle. Here's what I believe. I'm okay with big government. It was under the Democrats that we got a lot of big government. Social Security, Medicare, unions, Save a Tree, Hug an Owl, OSHA. All those big government programs were under the Democrats. So they're not so afraid of it. We don't like too much intrusion, but we give them a lot more power. We believe in social programs as well as free market. We like to take care of the poor, the Medicaid, those big government welfare programs were under the Democrats. We don't like that trickle-down effect. We kind of like what I call the wedgie effect. You know how your pants creep up and kind of get stuck? Well, if you bring it from the middle up, raise the minimum wage, tax breaks to middle income, give those breaks to the middle income, we feel. If there's a strong middle class, we all do well. So we believe in free market, but we believe in those social programs. We believe in having the federal guidelines for big government. We believe in not top down, but middle up. Very different than the other side. So here's a joke I have to tell you because you think about it. Waiter in a restaurant, lady comes in and he says, "Madame, tonight's special is braised tongue." "Ugh," she says, "I would never eat anything from a cow's mouth." He says, "Very good, madame. Will you have eggs tonight?" The reason I tell that joke is it's all how you look at it. It's not right or wrong. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. So the right is not wrong and the left is not right, or vice versa. It's just two different ways of looking how we can best govern this country. So start with that. We are equal. We have different points of view. And in a democracy, it goes both ways. When did this start, class? I used to be a teacher. You forgot that part. When did this start? When did we start saying how much government? You already answered something. How much government? You can't be first in your class all the time. How much government is too much? What is the role of government? When did this start? Okay, you're the brave one. When?
1776.
Right. He gets a gold star. You want to move to the front? 1776. We started this argument. What is the role of government? Where should the power be? Should it be in the executive branch? Should it be in Congress? What is the power structure of this country? So this isn't a new argument, but it sounds new and it feels new because something happened when you all elected Bill Clinton as president. I say you all, the American people. We elected Bill Clinton and we put a Democrat in the White House, and he thanked the American people for letting him live his dream. He should have thanked Hillary for letting him live. But aside from that, we put a Democrat in the White House and we elected a majority of Republicans to the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years. That was huge. You're not safe in the back of the class, by the way. I'm watching. It was huge. We put a group of Republicans, a majority, for the first time in 40 years, and the Democrats lost their power. Then what did we do? We elected W, and we put a majority of Republicans in the House, the Senate, and in the presidency. That's why it's important for you to understand what this side, the conservative, right, whatever you want to call it, what the ideology is. Because if you have Republicans or conservatives, whatever you say, in the House, the Senate, and the presidency, what are you going to do? Free market reform, tax breaks to big business, less regulation, trickle-down effect, personal responsibility, all of the ideology that this side really believes is the best way to go. Then what do? We Americans, we elect Barack Obama and we put a majority of Democrats in the House and the Senate and in the presidency. We Americans. So what's the philosophy we're going to adhere to now? Big government, more social programs, tax breaks to the middle income. All the things that we've been seeing happen are because of the basic ideologies of both sides. That's what I wanted you to understand in politics. So when you hear a politician saying, we don't want more big government, that's a big government idea. What side of the aisle is that representative from? Not that one. The one from the right or from the Republican Party. Because that's where he or she is coming from. And then you hear the other arguments that this is a government-run whatever. It may come from this side. So even if you don't see the D or the R next to their name, you have a pretty good idea who's saying what. And that doesn't, again, make them right or wrong. It's just where they're coming from. So that's your politics 101. The bottom line is, your mind is like a parachute. It works best when it's opened. So don't shut out the other side. Hear what they have to say. Decide what it is you believe. And you don't have to be 100% anything. You can take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and that's how our country's grown. Don't shut your friends and neighbors out. It's just two different ways of looking at solving the problems. That's your politics. Now, Social Security. What's one of the biggest federal programs we have? Social Security. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I want to make sure we all know where we're coming from. Social Security. You pay in 10 years or 40 working credits. You are eligible to collect. When you are retired, you become disabled. You're the spouse of a worker or the child of a worker. That's how it works. Notice I didn't say if you're here illegally, you can get Social Security. only people who have paid in to the system 40 work credits are eligible to collect it. So those people who think those women popping out those babies, we know some of those we've read about, or those illegals stealing our Social Security, not true. So let's get that out of the way. Only those people who have participated legally or families. Anybody who's paid in is entitled to collect, even if they're Bill Gates. Social Security is not income-based. It's based on your contributions over a whole work life history. That's the way it works. It's an equal opportunity program. Let's clear something else up. Does it go broke? How many of you read that? Disaster, going broke, insolvent. Well, let me tell you something that's very easy to understand. You always have people paying into the system, so it never goes broke. The question is it enough? Not going broke. And all these articles you read that it says insolvent, going broke. I've on my Friday letter, I've taken out all the horrible words that I've read that lead you to believe there's no money left. Let me tell you how it works. Those people who are working, anybody here working still? Good. Are you making a lot of money? Those people who are still working, even if they're collecting Social Security, that money immediately goes out to pay current retirees. So the money is a transfer from generation to generation. So the money immediately goes out. What is left over by law is invested in government issue bonds. Government issue bonds by law. Sir, do you know the difference between a bond and a man? Well, actually, I was going to say bonds mature. By law, what's left over after everyone's been paid is invested in government-issued bonds. Those bonds are used to run the government. So that means lots of things. It's like your credit card. They don't keep your money in the bank or in your checking account. They use it. So that money is used to run the government. And the interest is accrued and paid back when the bonds mature. Once the government has met its budget or its debt obligation at the end of that fiscal year, what's left over is invested in government special T-bills. That's called the surplus. And the surplus at this point is over $2 trillion, well over. Now, we know because of the projections by the Social Security Administration out 75 years, by the way, it's the only agency that looks out 75 years, and the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, both nonpartisan, that we can pay full benefits till 2037. How old will you be? Who's good at math? 2037, if we make no changes. It used to be 2042, and they've downed it to 2037. In 2037, there becomes a 20% shortfall projection. This is what they project. You know, the statisticians? A statistician is an accountant with less personality. But they take those numbers and they project out that we will have a 20 to 25% shortfall. So when your children retire, if it's after 2037, they would be missing about 25% of their full benefit. So the challenge here in the year 2009 is to figure out how to make up that 20% shortfall. Not that it goes broke. It's making up 20% shortfall. And that's doable many different ways. So my main message to you is Social Security doesn't go broke. It can be fixed so that that 20% shortfall is made up so they get 100%. And that's really the issue, not a lot of the scare tactics. Now, people always usually ask me, well, what about the money they stole and they didn't pay back? That is true. We borrowed from the Social Security Trust Fund under LBJ to pay for the Vietnam War. And it was not paid back. And that is why We now invest in government issue bonds. That is why the retirement age is now 67 for your children. And that is why there's a double tax on some of your Social Security if you're upper income. Because they knew the baby boomers were coming and they prepared for it. And so that the money could not also be misused. Any questions on Social Security? I could tell you a lot more, but I only have a certain amount of time. Yes, ma'am. Is it true that undocumented immigrants pay into Social Security? It is true. Some of them may, but they will not collect. They will not collect. Yes, it is. If they have a false Social Security card and they're so that someone will hire them, they will be paying into the system. I had a very interesting case. I was speaking in Chicago and it was a Latino group. And someone said, I have a friend who came to this country over 50 years ago and was issued a Social Security card in the 60s by the Social Security Administration. And he's now over 70 and he's not collected because he's afraid to come forward. Will he be able to collect his Social Security? And you know what the answer is? No. He can collect it if he comes forward. They will send him back to his country of origin. This is since 9/11. Send him back to the country, and then he, if he can prove he's paid in all these years, they will allow him back in legally. But he's afraid to do that. Plus, after 70 years, over 50 years, he doesn't have any ties to his old country. So they're very clear on that. You must be a legal citizen. I always say statistics are like bikinis. What they reveal is very interesting, but what they conceal is vital. I mix up my numbers, so I'm very careful with that. But Bill Gates only pays that top amount. That's why it's equal. There are many people in this room who may have paid on $106,000. And those below that pay according to their work history. So it's topped out.
I was under the impression that, the politicians have been robbing the Social Security Trust Fund for 30 years, not just during LBJ's era. These bonds, have they ever been replenished or anything?
Always replenished. That's why, have they ever defaulted on a payment? Never. Never. Now, the surplus can be used in times of war and recession legally. And it is being used for that. And with that, we're still fine till 2037.
But they're putting IOUs in there in this place,
yes,
right?
Yes, they are.
That the taxpayers have to pay back sometime?
Eventually. Now, everybody talks about having a lockbox, Democrats and Republicans. The problem with a lockbox is everybody has a key. They like to use that surplus as a slush fund. That's correct.
But we have to pay it back.
It does get paid back.
Ms. Feldman, my name is John Edward Hall. You share the same name as our former First Lady, Laura Bush, as well as my mother, Laura Hall. I would like to know a little bit more about what major you had at American University.
Okay. I had a double major, communication and education. So I was a school teacher in all the years that my children were growing up. So I grew up with them, and then I graduated. And I changed careers when my youngest went to college. Yes. Okay, well, I'll be very quick because he wants to know what I did at the National Science Foundation. No, I had been a school teacher, and part of my expertise was in science. So there was a program that was started in Maryland called Hands-on Science. And there was a 4-year grant to duplicate that program across the country. And so I was hired to do that. And that's when I started playing with the big boys. And you know what I found out? The classroom is a very small place. And I decided I liked being out here, and I liked taking my skills as a teacher and a communicator. So I got the job with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare 18 years ago, because I learned if I wasn't going to be in the classroom, I wanted to teach older children. And I wanted to do something that I cared very much about. Let's stick to the subject, and then I'll be happy to talk to you afterwards, if that's okay with you. Okay?
I fall into a strange category that I can't explain. I retired from civil service, and I do need 3/4, but when I went to check, it won't do me any good.
She falls under something called WEP. Let's see. Windfall elimination. Thank you. And there's two things for government workers: government pension offset, GPO, and windfall elimination. What happened was, if you worked for the government and you were eligible for a pension, and then you worked in under the Social Security Administration, you would be eligible for Social Security. And years back, they decided they didn't want double dippers because you got a good pension from the government. So even if you worked for Social Security or quarters, they penalize government workers and their spouses. That has been a NARF, National Association of Retired Federal Employees, issue for years, and the National Committee. We have lobbied to get that repealed, and we call it a double taxation. By the way, in recent years, they have changed that law so that it doesn't always apply. But in the meantime, you are the beneficiary of being screwed. That's a technical term. So we really have tried to lobby for this. It wasn't going to happen during the last administration because the push was to privatize Social Security. People still believe that Social Security is going broke. And let me just tell you this word, entitlement. When you hear any politician talk about entitlements, they're talking about three things: Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They are not the same. Social Security pays for itself 100%. It doesn't take one penny from taxpayers, other than your own money you've paid in. It does not contribute one penny to the deficit, because it pays for itself. And by the way, if any of you were business people, Social Security works on a 1% administrative overhead. That's pretty darn good. When we think of big government, most people think, oh, they can't do anything right. It's waste, it's fraud, it's abuse. Well, Social Security runs on 1% or less and pays for itself completely. Medicare is different. Medicare, you all know, is cost-sharing, and we'll talk about that next. But Medicaid, which I'm not going to cover today, is paid for 100% by your taxes. That's welfare. Everybody in this room pays for Medicaid recipients. It's a match between the state and the federal government, and you all pay for it from your taxes. So when they put these three programs together and they say, we can't afford entitlements, that's very dangerous, because they're lumping Social Security in with two other programs that are financed very differently. So if they want to have a commission to solve these problems, are they going to really look at three separate programs, or are they going to put it all on seniors? Because there are other entitlement programs. There's farm subsidies. There's all kinds. SNL bailout was an entitlement. You know, if you have money in the banks, you're entitled to be insured for a certain amount. But they're only talking about programs for seniors and the poor. So just be aware of that when you read about we can't afford entitlements. The question is, which ones? Don't put them all together. Let's move to Medicare, because healthcare has people all agitated. So let's talk about what is Medicare first, and then I'll put it in the umbrella of what's going on in Washington with healthcare and across the country. Medicare. I like to say Medicare is like a hospital gown. It doesn't give you full coverage, and you know what's hanging out in the back. It was a good program in 1965 when it was started, and it's still a pretty darn good program. And by the way, this big government works on 3.1%. administrative overhead. That's how much it costs to run Medicare, which is a government-run program. Okay? I love those people who say, I don't want big government, but don't mess with my Medicare. It's a government program. It's universal. That's another word that scares people. All it means is if you're 65, you're eligible for Medicare. Now, Social Security, you're eligible after you've paid in a certain amount of credits. Medicare, you're entitled to entitlement just because you're 65. So that is a very different kind of entitlement. If you're 65, you're entitled to enroll in Medicare. Okay, Medicare A, the hospital part. That is the part that is in big trouble. They predict that 2017, the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, which came out of your FICA tax, will be depleted. And that's where the biggest problem is. Then you have B, the doctor part. Medicare B is the original Medicare, where you choose a doctor. Medicare pays 80% when you go, and you're responsible for 20%. So you buy a policy that covers that 20% called a Medigap policy. So Mrs. Smith gets a call from her doctor, and he says, Mrs. Smith, I've got some bad news. I know you were here with your husband for these Medicare tests, and there are so many Mr. Smiths, we got his test mixed up with somebody else's. She said, well, you have to take it over again. He says, well, I'm sorry, Medicare will only pay for it one time. She said, well, what do you think he has? Well, your husband either has Alzheimer's or he's got AIDS. Well, she said, you have to take the test again. I have to know what he has. He says, no, Medicare just won't pay for it, but I'll tell you what you do. Take him downtown. If he finds his way home again, then don't sleep with him. Medicare B is supposed to pay for anything that is medically necessary. So that doesn't mean that it pays for everything, but if your doctor codes it that it is necessary to have this test, Medicare B will cover it, and your supplement will fill in the 20%. Then we have Medicare C. It used to be called Medicare C, then it was called Medicare Plus. Then they changed it to Medicare Advantage. They're all the same. A, B, and this is C. Medicare Advantage, and this is important information, is private insurance. They added this under the last administration because we like the free market, that you now have the choice of joining a private Medicare managed care organization, an HMO. So this man dies and goes to heaven. And St. Peter's letting everybody in, everybody in, everybody in. And when he gets up to the front, St. Peter says, whoa, stop. And he says, why stop? Everybody else went in. He said, oh, that lady was a mother of five. What a saint. That man was a carpenter like Jesus, worked with his hands. Good man. What do you do? He said, well, I am the manager of an HMO. He said, I'm sorry, of course you can go in, but you can only stay 3 days. Managed care manages your care. So you sign up with this company and they decide what are your fees, what are your co-pays, and what is covered, what doctors are in the plan, and so forth. So this has become a very important issue because these plans are subsidized by the government. Because when they did this Medicare Advantage, they wanted these companies to come in to offer it to seniors. So the government gives them, it's about, I think it's $900 a year per senior to come in and join their plans. So it's a good deal for these Medicare Advantage companies. But when you sign up, you are signing up with a private company. Then we got Medicare, that was C. Now we have D, prescription drug benefit. And boy, Democrats and Republicans agreed, we need prescription drugs because healthcare today is predicated on many of the drugs we take. Everybody agreed. Does it bother anybody that when you go into the drugstore, the cigarettes are in the front and the prescription drugs are in the back? That bothers me. But anyway, you go to the back of the store, and this couple met. They met in the Senior Citizen Independent Living Center. They fell in love. They went to Crate and Barrel. They didn't see anything they liked. So they went to CVS, and they went back to the prescription drug counter, and they said, do you carry Prilosec? Pharmacist said, sure. Do you carry Lipitor? Sure. We carry all the major drugs. She said, can we register here for our wedding? Who needs Crate and Barrel? Prescription drugs are something that most people use at some point in their life. But they passed this Medicare D when we had all the power on this side and we didn't want more big government. So we subsidized the drug companies to come in and offer it to you. Again, private insurance companies offering you prescription drug benefits. So A and B are the traditional Medicare. C and D are private companies offering you either a managed care plan or a prescription drug plan. And that plan is so private that in the law, it says the government may not compete because the Democrats wanted to have a government option where the government could negotiate for all of the Medicare recipients to offer a prescription drug benefit. But in the law, it says they may not compete. So that's the Medicare we have. And most people are pretty happy with it. A, running out of money. B, the doctor part. C, managed care that's getting a subsidy. And D, the prescription drug part that cannot compete, that is totally private, that each insurance company negotiates their own prices. So here's the deal. Medicare has always kept costs down because the reimbursement level has been lower than the private sector. Most seniors love it. Most doctors aren't thrilled. They don't feel they're reimbursed enough. So it's become a very important part of this whole healthcare debate. So any questions on Medicare on its own, and then I'll tell you how it fits into the big picture. We know how it works now. Good. Oh, yes.
Don't the hospitals feel the same way the doctors now?
That they're under
reimbursed?
The hospitals are happier with Medicare than the doctors because their reimbursement rate isn't that low. They make a lot of money off of Medicare. They're more concerned about the uninsured that walk through their doors through Medicaid. That's their bigger issue. You're welcome. Okay, let's talk. That's how did you have a question? You're just waving. Hi. Okay. That's how Medicare works. And we do have to understand how these programs work. Oh, can I call on him, Bill? Okay. You've been vetoed. We'll get you later. He's got a clipboard. He must be impotent. Okay. Here's the deal. Here's the deal. Healthcare reform. We have to decide, and I'm delighted there's some people who are a little bit younger in this audience, and I hope you have some good questions. When we talk about healthcare reform, hey, no talking in class. I don't care if you're president, no talking in class. Just teasing. No sleeping either, by the way. I got eyes in the back of my head. Here's the deal. We have to decide in this country, number one, if we need to change things. There are people in this room who are probably not convinced we need to do anything. But on the left and on the right, there is an agreement that the escalating cost of healthcare is rising too fast. That if healthcare keeps costing as much as it does, year after year, rising by 2, 6, 10, 11%, that we can no longer afford it. That is an agreement on both sides, whether you agree or not. So we have to start with the problem is cost and coverage. Can we afford to cover more people? And how much will it cost? But they agree we can't afford to keep raising the cost as rapidly as it has been going up. So let's start from there. That you may not be feeling it, but you will feel it when your Social Security COLA doesn't go up, but your healthcare costs do. Those of you who are living on a fixed income, healthcare costs are rising, co-payments are rising. I will tell you my husband's Medicare D policy. He takes no prescription drugs. So I put him in Humana the first year. It was $12 a month. Great. He didn't take anything, $12 a month. The same policy the next year was $18.50. This year, the same policy was $37. That is the rising cost of health care. So it's very real. Your co-payments, your costs will go up. Here's the issue. Do we care, number one, and what is reform? Let me present something else to you. They're using the word healthcare reform. And by the way, I'm doing this from the middle. I'm just trying to explain it. What are we reforming? There's no plan. We don't have healthcare. If you're under Medicare, you do. If you're under the VA, you do. But the rest of the people, these young guys, they either buy insurance or they maybe have a boss or they're saying, I'm healthy. I don't need to put out the money. There's no healthcare system to reform. Okay, so when they say it, no wonder you're confused, because what is it we're reforming? What we're looking at doing is changing the system to slow the rate of growth. And there are opinions all over the board. So on the House of Representatives side, there are three committees that deal with health. And those three committees have come out with a bill. And that bill has been changing as we speak. You all heard of the death panels? Well, that's already out. First of all, it didn't exist as people thought it did. But I heard of a new plan. It's called Cash for Codgers. You know, the other one worked so well. You know, Cash for Clunkers. This one, if you want to have a baby, you turn in an old person. But you get more money if they smoke. Eat a lot of red meat, 10 pounds over where the government says they should be, you get a good rebate. If they're on the second tier, they just have a little too much fat. Maybe they don't exercise. You know, you have two tiers. You get a little less money for them. I think people should believe that more than they believe death paddles. But anyway, that bill, which does have 1,000 pages, and everybody said to me they haven't even read it. They were made to read it. They had an all-day event where they read it line by line by line. They made them sit there in class. It was mandatory. But it's very complicated. Here's what I'd like to say about this healthcare reform. Just relax. All right? Just relax. I know you are. Just relax. Okay, good. I've been seeing him. I know. Ben Cardin is one of our congressmen. Oh, I've seen a lot of them. We had one of our congressmen and our senator in Maryland who always watches the Food Channel to relax. I was talking to his wife. He had vodka last week. And he's not a drinker, but he needed vodka. Here's what I want you to think about. This healthcare discussion is like a puzzle. The problem is we don't know what the final picture should look like. Think about trying to put together a puzzle and you don't know what the final picture is that you're shooting for. And secondly, the pieces keep changing shape. And that's why people are very agitated, because we can't say, on the conservative side, we can say, we don't want big government. We don't want rationing. We don't want socialism. I always think there's a big government, socialism, rationing cost. We get that. That's easy. We understand that. This side is like Will Rogers. I don't belong to any political party. I'm a Democrat. Because on this side, we're talking about this House proposal, and it is a bill. It came out of three committees, but it has not gone on to the Congress because it's changing as we speak, especially after these town hall meetings. So these three committees each came out with their part. They've tried to put them all together, and we're panicking and freaking out about all these amendments. The Senate has not come out with their bill yet, and it's going to be very different. So we have to see what they come out with and then what they present to the Congress. Then the Congress has to take these two bills that will eventually come out, fight like heck over them, go back to committee, and see if they can come out with one bill that Congress will then have to vote on. And that's, before that, when they both come out with their bills, that's when you should get agitated. That's when you say, this is what we really have. What are the parts of it? What are the most important parts? And that's when you should call and write and pay attention. Right now, it's a moving target. And it is very unsettling because they are trying to figure out, where do we go from here? How do we slow the rate of growth? And there's so many moving parts. The words that are scaring people are universal. Universal health care, in the context they have been using it, is that everyone should have access to coverage. Whether they make it mandatory or not, we don't know. But they would like to have, on this side, some would like to have what's called a public plan. That would be similar to Medicare, in that the government would oversee the rules of that public plan. So it would be administered like CMS, Consumer Medicare Medicaid Services, like Medicare. There would be a unit to oversee it. And that seems to be giving people a lot of apoplexy, because it is big government. I'm not going to lie to you, like Medicare. But it has this awful aura. So now they're talking about changing that to an exchange of private insurance companies getting together and offering a menu, if you will, of several plans. And we yet don't know what that's going to look like. On this side, we really want to keep the government out of it. Here's your problem. And I'm not going to ask you this question because I don't want to put you on the spot. But there are many people in this room who don't trust the government. And there are many people in this room who don't trust the insurance companies or the pharmaceutical companies. So who do you trust? That is your challenge. We know that healthcare is a commodity today. It's big business. Remember when they used to call a doctor instead of a provider? Ask your provider. You know? We've changed the way we think about medicine because it is so expensive. So really and truly, those of you who have Medicare, you have to stop and think, what do we want to see happen for everyone else? I've got mine. You don't want yours to change. But what do you really want for everybody else? Well, I represent Medicare, and here's what we have looked at. We've looked at the House bill. We pretty much have an idea what was going to come out of the Senate bill last week. And the House bill was very good to Medicare. The House bill was adding to Medicare, even while taking out $500 billion. How were they doing it? Taking away the extra money they give to Medicare Advantage plans, taking away the subsidy, closing the donut hole, and fixing Medicare D to cost you less money, taking more from the drug companies. And they were also taking money away from hospitals from reimbursing in that bill. By the way, they were raising the reimbursement to doctors under that bill. So we've looked at it and say, we'd come out okay with Medicare under that version. The Senate version has more means testing in it. Now, I'm saying the version as of today. Remember, this is a moving target. But what we do know is this. If we don't slow the rate of growth for healthcare for everyone, then they will go after Medicare. Because Medicare is a budget item. So if we don't do something about slowing the costs that put out for healthcare for everyone, then we cannot sustain Medicare. So you do have a stake. You do have a dog in this fight. But it's not going to be an event. If we pass a bill we being the American people or the Congress. It's not going to be an event. It's going to be a process. They can't do it all in one fell swoop of signing something. It's going to be the beginning. This side is afraid it's going to be a beginning of rationing, socialized, big government. Those are the words that are being used. By the way, rationing is one of those words that insurance companies already do. They decide what they'll pay for, how long you can stay in the hospital. Medicare does that to some degree as well. Socialism is when the government has complete control of everything. Nobody's talking about that. So what we are talking about is adding to a government program or not, and that's at the heart of it. And most of us are getting so cynical, we don't trust anybody. But guess what? You got to trust somebody. We've got to take a chance on something, either on not doing something or beginning a process. Your turn for questions. I promise to leave time.
I have a simple question. European countries have had the same kind of health insurance we are talking about now for 70 years in Britain, for 120 years in Germany. Why do we have to reinvent the wheel instead of looking at their systems, which obviously have been working through world wars and through depressions, and see what is best and applicable to us?
I can give you a simple answer. Taxes. England, Canada, Germany, all of those countries that have healthcare for everyone pay for it in taxes. You all don't want to pay more taxes. Let me tell you something, because I'm a grown-up. Ain't no free lunch. We want our politicians to promise us better health care that we don't have to pay for. And I wish Democrats or Republicans would say, I believe in free market and I want you to have such and such, and here's how we're going to pay for it, because we're going to pay for it. Or this side's going to say, the government program, here's how we're going to really pay for it. It is going to cost us if we want to do X. If we don't want to do too much, maybe we can fudge it different ways. But your answer is, we don't pay the taxes that they do to cover every individual. We've decided at this point in history not to.
In your opinion, will the Advantage plans survive in the ongoing?
I can give you an answer to that. Yes, the good ones will. There are over 40 Advantage plans, and the ones that are in it for the money. And by the way, it's a very unregulated industry. So there are some good ones and there are some really bad ones. I have a lady who is an independent insurance broker. She still is. And she gets calls all the time because she's in her 80s. So she's the perfect demographic. And someone calling her to sell her an Advantage plan. And he said, you know, it's no premiums and this and that. And she said, will you cover my cancer drugs? Dead silence on the other end. So there's some very bad ones. I would say the bad ones will drop out. And the big ones, Humana, AARP, a few of the names you've heard, they will pick up market share. So AARP that sells Advantage plans is lobbying to take away the subsidy, because they're going to pick up the ones that drop out.
I know all those politicians are lawyers in Washington, D.C., so I guess that's why this tort reform has never been mentioned. My grandson's a doctor, and you ought to see his bills from insurance companies just to protect him from that. Several thousand dollars a month. Now, is that going to be on the new program?
So far, it is not, and I'll tell you why. And I think that's why we have to remember this is going to be not going to be an event. It's going to be a process. There's two things they're not touching that I agree with you they need to do: tort reform and immigration. They're too hot to put in this mix. So what I think, what I believe they have to do something is they have to have a starting point, and then in committee, by law, they will have to go after some of the biggest cost enhancers. So you're right. but it's not in there. It's not in the House bill. We don't know what will be in the Senate bill. His question is, will TRICARE survive?
Yes, for veterans, will TRICARE for life
survive? Absolutely. This president is committed to expanding health care benefits for veterans and supporting it. That's on the record. So I think it will survive. And there's so much more we have to do for veterans because we have new types of injuries. I live right near NIH, and NIH has had an infusion of money to study brain injury. As a matter of fact, they're changing the highways and everything for the medical centers at NIH. And I can see that in the works. And also, we're right near Walter Reed, which has been getting a lot of money. Yes. Oh, I'm so glad. Somebody under the age of...
So my general question is, what are the proposed mechanisms to reduce the rising cost of healthcare? I mean, it seems that we want to talk about it, but we need specific actions and mechanisms that will reduce, one, you know, inflating cost of healthcare due to, you know, extra tests, more expensive prescription drugs, and such. So I just want to know.
Well, there's a lot of things outside of Medicare. And Medicare, I can speak specifically, but they're talking about reimbursement rates for hospitals. They're saying if we have a public plan and everyone has insurance, that will cover costs for hospital who are covering the uninsured. So they're thinking they will have more business and more reimbursement if people have insurance. That's one thing. They're talking about outcomes measurement, that right now we do a lot of defensive medicine, as this person said, because it's called CYA medicine, cover your medicine, because of malpractice insurance. They're looking at different standards. And a good example of that is, and doctors are afraid of this because they don't want anybody to tell them how to practice. But I use the example of mammograms and mastectomies. That used to be standard of care. And through the studies, they found out that lumpectomies were just as effective, and that is now the standard of care. So they're talking about using standard of care measurements to reimburse. So that would cover some of the malpractice. If you are using standard of care rather than all these extra tests to see what you should do, and that would be a choice, by the way, not written in stone. This is about choice. You would save money. They're talking about medical records. If all records were put on disk, or one agency or one doctor could talk to another, all that paperwork that you have to hire extra people to do, if it were standardized to some degree. They're talking about covering everybody so that you cannot deny pre-existing conditions. I have a great nephew who has juvenile diabetes. He's graduating from college, and he has to get off of his parents' plan. No one will insure him. So if he were insured, we would think that he would be healthier and cost less at later years. This thing that was taken about end of life, that was about reimbursing the doctor. That's what it was about. So that he could talk to you all, if you chose, about end-of-life decisions. What is a durable power of attorney? What is a living will? What is hospice? What would be your wishes? And most seniors, by the way, if they are asked, would rather not have so much end-of-life medicine. If they're asked. If they're not asked, everything will be done to sustain life. So there are many different parts that would cut costs. The highest costs are in subsidies to Medicaid people, to the poor, to businesses to subsidize your retirees and your employees. All of those subsidies would be cut to some degree. So there's a million different ways, and some of those will be taken out. There will be more that are added. Does that kind of answer? Yeah. They have lots of different ways.
I recently had a hospital experience. I was in for 3 days. Bill came to somewhere in the neighborhood of just the hospital portion, $27,000. So Medicare paid, I believe it was about $17,000. Now, my question is, where is the deficit? Where is the problem with the hospitals? If the hospital says, well, we had a bill here for $27,000 and we dropped $10,000 out of the bottom right off the top, that's terrible. But if they were willing to take $17,000 and that met their needs, then there was no...
Healthcare is like a balloon. You squeeze one part and another part gets bigger. So private insurance companies that these young guys are paying into are charging them more to help subsidize your Medicare. And that's why the private sector is connected. If those people walk into the emergency room and pay nothing, we end up paying for it through our prescription drugs, through our Medigap policy. If you figure out what you spend every month on your prescription drug policy and on your Medigap policy, you've paid quite a bit into the system over the years that you were healthy. So it's money that is floated that you've been putting in. Here's how insurance works. You all buy house insurance. If your house doesn't burn down, you don't collect a penny. If you live, God willing, to 80, 90 something, and many of you, knock on wood, don't go to the doctor, don't go in the hospital, you're paying for your hospital visit. That's how insurance works. It's a big risk pool. By the way, the idea of this insurance, public insurance plan, is to have a big risk pool. I didn't ask you this question on Social Security, but here's a tough question, class. What's the word, the first word of Social Security? Social. It works because so many people are in it, and a lot of people die and don't collect it. That's how you pay for the widow and the child and the disabled. Or they work till 65, they die at 70, and all that money they've paid in goes back to the risk pool. And that's how they see this public plan working, that so many people go in it, healthy people, young, healthy people, that it covers those that need greater health care. So here's another question you have to answer for yourself. I'm throwing one back at you. Should health care be a business or should it be nonprofit? Should it be healthcare? Should it be a for-profit business, which it is? Or should we remove for-profit and make it a nonprofit? And I don't have the answer. That's for you to decide. And that's a very central question to what's happening. What I'm thrilled with all of you here is that you're not rabid. Really and truly. What bothers me are the people who are so excited about this, but if you ask them solutions, or if you ask them what they really want, or if you ask them, is healthcare a right or a privilege, they haven't really answered those questions for themselves. And there's no right or wrong. It's just important questions we need to ask ourselves. And whether we like this president or not, this is what he ran on. This is his vision. And if we disagree with it, that's fine. But we disagree with the issue, not with the president. We can disagree with the issue. And you all are being civil and asking wonderful questions. I was ready for the tomatoes, but I'm thrilled that seniors care enough to come and learn whether we agree or we disagree. Continue. A woman.
Absolutely. Let me start out by saying that I believe health care should be considered a universal human right. But we do not choose to be sick.
We need a question.
Now, I'll get to the question. Everybody seems to be worried about the cost. And I believe I saw a figure that in the course of 10 years, I'll get to that, it will protect, it will cost about $1.3 trillion. Is it correct that under the current system, which excludes a large segment of our population, the cost over the same period of time will be $1 trillion? In other words, 0.3 less than universal. Is there any sense in it? And why, if these figures are correct, aren't they made more prominent in what we hear in the media and what we read?
Okay. Her question is about the cost, and that's a very good question, especially in these economic times, because that's making all of us very uncomfortable because we know it's a down economy. There's several ways to look at that. Yes, you are correct. The House bill, as it is today, would cost $1 trillion over a 10-year period. The cost of health care is projected to go up more than that if we do nothing. So you have to decide, and I am not an economist, do we put money up front to save money down the road? It's in many ways like the environmental issues. Do we give cash for clunkers to get some of those cars off the road? Do we give cash for codgers to save money down the road? Those numbers that you all hear and read every day, again, are fluid. And we can use numbers two ways. We can use them to support us or to enlighten us. So it's very difficult to say, where do we put the emphasis on the money spent? And can we afford not to spend it? And the truth is, nobody has the answer. We've never been at this point in time in history. This is a first where we've had this economy in this time with this type of healthcare, with all the good things about it. So nobody has that answer. And that's what we're struggling with. I wish I could say yes or no.
You mentioned that the overhead rate for Medicare was 3.1%. Mm-hmm. The Wendell Potter, a former executive for a health insurance company, has stated that originally the health insurance company started at 5% overhead, but they've been forced by Wall Street to expand that to 20%, 30% or more. That seems like a very likely target for cost savings. Are any of the bills covering that, attacking that?
Well, it's interesting. The insurance industry offered to cut costs voluntarily, as did the prescription drug companies by offering to pay 50% of the Medigap donut hole. On this side of the aisle, that's what you're going to hear. You're going to hear the insurance companies voluntarily offering to cover everyone with pre-existing conditions, voluntarily offering many things out of fear of competing with a public plan. By the way, they fear that if they have to compete with the government, it will put them out of business, which is the same argument they gave when we started Medicare. And that's on the record of Ronald Reagan saying, this is the road to socialism and the end to private industry. So we don't know what the actual effect would be, but we do know by history that it has not put the insurance companies out of business. Does that answer your question?
It is irresponsible and stupid to talk about health care without adding the word insurance, but for the very reason that you mentioned. It is, insurance is gambling. That's what it's all about. So therefore, health care must be added with the word insurance. Here's the question. We know about Samuel Keynes because Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama studied under him. Hillary Clinton had her chance. It failed. Is Barack Obama going to bring our country to what I call Keynesian doom? Because if he does get it passed without knowing what he's doing?
The question is, will Barack Obama bring our country to Keynesian doom? I don't know what Keynesian means, but doom, I know what that means. I don't think so. I really do not think so. I am a patriot, but I look at Congress every day. I see people come to work every day to help get this done. Some are smarter than the others. Some take more money from private industry than others. But 9 out of 10 come to work every day to wrestle with a very difficult problem. I don't think we're at doom. I think it's like Winston Churchill said, you can trust the American people to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. We're a young country.
We have time for one short question and then we have
Okay. I am a medical student, and so one thing that interests me is physician salaries. Mm-hmm. My understanding is that many countries, for example in Europe, pay their physicians a lot lower than the United States. Do you think physician salaries should be cut? And also, do you think anything of that sort will happen in the near future?
Well, as far as Medicare, the House bill, as I said, raises their salary. Do I think physician salaries should be cut? No, I don't. But I think there's a lot of parts to that, the cost of medical school. I think that personally, this isn't a national committee position, but working with other gerontologists, the medical school is so expensive that when doctors come out, they're so in debt that they need to make a living, not only to pay back their... So I think we need to do something about medical school. And I think that we need to remember we've gotten into this business model of medicine. I think we need to get back to it as an art. And it is not something that can go completely by the books. But I think we need options. If you look at England, you have a two-tiered system. So you have people who are very happy to work in the system and have a salary and have set hours. And then you have those who choose private practice. And I do think that's more where we will go. I think we will put in some sort of a system eventually, not right away. It's going to be down the road, where there are options for people, because there are many people. I have a nephew who has worked for one of the large HMOs who's been very happy with it up until now. He's leaving. But it worked for him for a while. I have a brother-in-law who wants nothing to do with anybody's plan or anybody's anything. He wants to practice the way he wants to practice. That's America. I think we will have that whole option. And I think that we, seniors in particular, need to stand up for physicians because we have relationships. We remember how it used to be. And once we got insurance, things changed because we weren't paying directly. We're never going back to those days unless you have a boutique practice where you have your patients pay up front and you limit them. There's no law against that. But in the old days, I have to tell you, I do a whole thing on healthcare. How many of you remember castor oil? Do you remember hearing about it? Oh my God. You go to the doctor, you had a stomach ache, you had whatever, they gave you castor oil. It was disgusting. It's poison, but that's what you got. You had a broken finger, this is what they did. It may be a little crooked, but you didn't sue. I mean, those days are gone. So I think medicine has changed. I want to hope that you go into medicine for healing and that you go in with the idea of whichever system you're under, you're going to do no harm. You're going to follow the Hippocratic Oath and help to heal the world and make us better. And you should be reimbursed for that. So here's my parting words. Don't you clap yet. This is true. We spend, and you listen to this, you can use this in medical school. We spend more money on Viagra and on breast implants than we spend on Alzheimer's research. That means in 20 years, we will have people with very perky bodies and no idea what to do with them. But the point of that is we pay for what we want. And so your challenge is to decide what do you want and then help to make it happen.
Sure.
Thank you all so much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.